Hello, everyone. Welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson. It is November 5th, 2019, which here in Pennsylvania is Election Day, which I never participate in for reasons that many of you already know. As always, I want to thank my donors and supporters. I desperately need your help, as always. And as I've said many times, this is a full-time job. And especially what I'm going to talk about today. I normally don't deal with day-to-day American politics because it's so vulgar. And the intelligence level that it displays is mind-numbing. As I've said before, American journalists don't really even claim expertise in any particular area. They talk about things either because they're told or this is, impeachment is a deadly serious thing, whether it's justified or not. And to have stand-up comics and people like, like Stephen Colbert and people like that, making jokes about it. And there's those kind of shows that they're half news, half comedy. And a huge number of people get their information from that. Stand-up comics and comedy shows are a substantial source of information for politics for Americans. And of course they're uniformly, not only ignorant, but liberal as most liberals are. I've also said many times before that the Constitution isn't a relevant document anymore for a whole bunch of reasons. The main reason, of course, is that it's been interpreted out of existence. The words in that document don't mean today what they used to mean. That's going to be actually the essential part of what we're talking about when it comes to impeachment. Most people, including most educated people, don't know the first thing about the political assumptions of colonial America. They have not read the Federalists and certainly haven't read the Anti-Federalists. And yet, of course, these are essential documents, especially the latter. The Constitution's only a few pages. It doesn't say very much. But it's also irrelevant because the society that created it doesn't exist. We're talking about a relatively small country in terms of, it was large in land area, but, sparsely populated, a few cities. And like everything, it was an aristocracy. And that's what was assumed at the time. In 1800, about 5% of the population could vote. And that makes a lot of sense to me, because actually voting mattered at the time, and voting was done often based on a personal connection. For what we call middle-class landowners, who were in Jefferson's sense free. Free meant that they were independent, that they weren't reliant on someone else for money. They were independent landowners, so they didn't work for somebody, and therefore they can't be influenced that way. And that was the assumptions that went into it. Mass democracy, the party system, and definitely the media have destroyed it. And none of these things could have been prophesied at the time. The media, and I'm referring to newspapers, magazines, entertainment media, and the news media on television, online, that's owned only by a handful of mostly Jewish investors. And there's only a few. And this is where people get information. This is where issues are considered important or not important. Arguments are considered good or bad. And none of these people are particularly knowledgeable. It's about attracting viewers. It's about entertainment. You know, foreign policy is really just expressed like an action movie. And we're dealing with serious issues here. And stand-up comics are making comments about this and jokes about this. And this is where people are. And really what wins the day is the best one-liner. Now, since Donald Trump was elected, and it's one of the reasons I want to talk about this, because in my life, and I think in American political history, there's never been a president that's been subjected to a barrage of hatred and contempt as Donald Trump, to the point where they'll make up anything. Nixon had it quite a bit. Andrew Johnson had it quite a bit from the radical Republicans. And of course, both of those guys were impeached. Nixon almost impeached. And at least at the time, you know, if you go back to the 1960 debate, for example, 1960 is my favorite election. It was extremely significant. Even in 1960, the level of intelligence and you know, the level that they spoke was far higher than anything today. Most of what they say wouldn't have been understood today. The Federalist isn't understood today. People don't know the assumptions and the lifestyle of colonial America, or even 1950s America, for that matter. Americans, educated Americans, live by a set of stereotypes that they accept because it's socially acceptable for them to believe it. Donald Trump has been savaged primarily because he wasn't initially during the campaign, he financed himself, which was outrageous. He wanted to slightly limit the number of illegal immigrants pouring over the border, which is really what caused corporate America to attack him. And he began pretty early on arresting large numbers of elite pedophiles. I think the number is now up to about 2,500. Now, we do not live in good economic times, and the president has no control or influence over the economy. The economy is purely a private set of investment decisions, largely filtered through banks. They're the ones who matter. But, as some of you know, Donald Trump is suing CNN for a very good reason, that they have violated the Lanham Act, which essentially deals with, among other things, false advertising. You can't make up stories about Donald Trump and insult him at every turn and then claim that you are a news agency that is nonpartisan and objective. And I actually believe he has a case. Part of the reason that this impeachment idea interests me is because it isn't based on anything of substance. I mean, at least with Bill Clinton, which I remember very well, at least that was based on perjury. It was a stupid issue with everything else that was that he was doing, or any politician was doing. Now that's what they grab onto, which is laughable. Even Andrew Johnson was really a point of procedure. And firing someone in the defense ministry that allegedly he wasn't allowed to do. In both cases, they took a minor issue because they hated him. Threats to impeach Donald Trump have been occurring since the day he was elected. The Congressional Black Caucus said because he doesn't accept, or at least they thought he doesn't accept the melting pot idea, which by the way isn't true, but they thought so at the time, he needs to be impeached because he's insulting and demeaning the office of the president. Technically, you don't have to commit an actual crime to be impeached. Now, there's an article out that I strongly recommend. I was very impressed by it. It's by John Orth, in Constitutional Commentary in 2000, Presidential Impeachment, the Original Misunderstanding. And it shows the incredible ignorance, whether it be academics or journalists, show in dealing with this question. Donald Trump is being impeached because the left is angry that they lost in 2016. Richard Nixon was impeached because the left was angry. They were destroyed at the polls in 1972. There is no other reason here. They chose Ukraine because it's obscure and no one knows anything about it. So Johnson's Law now is front and center. But the two things that destroyed the original conception of not only presidential election, but presidential impeachment is the rise of the party system and the media. The party system was not foreseen by the very aristocratic founders of the American state. Essentially, the Constitutional Convention, having no idea of any two-party system, expected a state to, you know, vote for a local candidate in the Electoral College, and in which case no one would ever gain a majority. Even James Madison said this is going to happen 19 times out of 20. And so the Electoral College was really just a stepping stone to the House of Representatives, who was supposed to be the main elector of the presidency. And at the time, the House was the only directly elected element, a part of the federal government. And it's meant to make the choice of president, because once the initial electoral system didn't produce a majority. And it says, you know, from the persons having the highest numbers, not exceeding three on the list of those voted for president, the House of Representatives shall choose immediately by ballot the president. So on the one hand, the electors in the college would be deadlocked, and so the House would then come in and elect the president. That was how people like James Madison expected the president to be elected. And making sure that states were the prime movers here, at least as far as the Electoral College is concerned, the initial conception of it, was the only way the Constitution could ever get passed. Because, of course, without it, it would simply favor the larger, more powerful regions. And this was meant to be the normal way. James Madison made it very clear here. And so in the initial Constitution, as well as the 12th Amendment, it was understood that the House of Representatives is going to be the kingmaker for the presidency. The problem was the rise of parties created the discipline to focus attention on only a handful of candidates. And then electors were organized by parties behind whoever that is. So he goes on to mention in 1825, it was the House that chose John Quincy Adams over Andrew Jackson. John Quincy Adams, I think got maybe 30% of the popular vote at the time. But the 12th Amendment only really made some minor reforms to the mechanism. But the emergence of parties, and of course the people who financed the parties, completely changed how presidents were to be elected. But the concept of impeachment then is immediately connected to the fact that they were supposed to be the electors of president. So they can create the president, they could recall the president. So, you know, 1801, you had another deadlock. And so, you know, the 12th Amendment it deals with these problems. But the point is, when the modern House initiates, an impeachment proceedings, it has no right to do so because it hasn't created the president as they were expected to do. It was understood that since they were going to be electing the president in the first place, they would then have the right to do the opposite. And of course, you know, the high crimes and misdemeanors is extremely vague. And this is really up to, you know, time and place as to when this was going to be defined. The impeachment of Andrew Johnson, which was 1868, of course, in 1999, with Bill Clinton, the only thing that really mattered was partisanship. No one cared about the actual issues. Perjury, you know, as if everyone judging Bill Clinton was a perjurer himself. It's an absolutely ridiculous idea. Now, of course, Donald Trump will not leave office because it would require, but at least 20 Republican senators to vote against him, which isn't going to happen. Although you never know that the entire ruling class is opposed to Donald Trump, with no exceptions, means that they have a lot of money to throw around here. But you know, the 18th century notion of the Constitution, this is gone forever. And the entire conception of both election of the president and his removal are almost completely lost to history. And that's why this article is so extremely important. Because of the rise of parties, the media, and party discipline, there's no way that the impeachment could ever work, because you need a supermajority in the Senate to make that happen. Now, as far as Trump is concerned, what many of us predicted concerning the so-called whistleblower, and this is how the media functions. They create these buzzwords and slogans and standardized arguments that people who don't know anything have to repeat, and they sound smart. There is no whistleblower here. This is a coup. Whether you like Trump or not is irrelevant. That's what this is. And the same thing with Nixon. The person who, the so-called whistleblower, is CIA. And now we know that it's Eric Kiramella. And, of course, now he has cold feet about testifying. Largely because he worked for Joe Biden. The former CIA director, John Brennan, and also the DNC, who was using relations with Ukraine, which, by the way, is one of Joe Biden's areas of control, and they worked together as a cabal to get rid of Trump. So now that we know who this person is, and they've been trying to protect his identity for a very, very long time, the entire thing has blown up. Now, the press isn't really talking about this except in trying to cover, because they're simply, you know, this is the media has created this whole cabal. And what Kiramella said, because he was close to Biden, is that he abuses office when somehow abuses office when he asked, Zelensky to look into Joe Biden and his son Hunter. So, which is, of course, is not a problem at any level. What mystifies me is that even if every single thing that the establishment is saying is true, Donald Trump has done nothing wrong. Now, these phone calls, and again, no one knows this either, these phone calls have many people on them. It's not a private conversation. Like, if I call somebody, there was a top National Security Council official who was on the line at the time, too. Tim Morrison, who was NSC Director for European Affairs, who was on the call, and he said that nothing was wrong. Nothing could have been wrong anyway. Even if he said, I'm not releasing this unless you do X, Y, and Z, there's still nothing wrong with that. The most so far that I've heard from the establishment is that somehow Ukraine's security against Russian invasion is so overwhelmingly important that to withhold these Javelin missiles means that he is incompetent to be president. That's what they're hanging on right now. Not that anyone knows anything about that or that they're even hearing that, but that's what they're claiming now. This is just as bad as the Russiagate thing. These are absolutely mindless. The level of intelligence you have to accept these is extremely low. These are simply emotional things. People who don't know the first thing about these topics can grab onto because it sounds scary and it sounds nasty. that in neither case is there anything problematic. The regime never claimed that Russia hacked the election. They never said that. They said that it was something about the DNC, which was simply Hillary Clinton's doing against Bernie Sanders, and it went no farther than that. The press simply invented the issue without really even saying so directly, that they created the result of 2016. Now, as it stands now, there's no indication that these so-called whistleblowers are ever going to testify. And it, to add to this nonsense, this third-grade garbage, they're claiming that we need to hide these people because Trump's going to kill them, or Putin's going to kill them, or something that they've simply invented. Now, Joe Biden, who much of his campaign has been financed by the Albanian drug cartels, campaigns for Senate years ago, and he's deep into that Kosovo mafia idea, hates Russia with a passion for some reason. But you're talking about here now a partisan CIA officer. Even the, again, so many of these, the House members are lawyers. Again, they don't really care, but they know most Americans aren't going to read this resolution or even understand what they're reading. So it doesn't matter what they say. And it doesn't matter even if they do, because the press, what they'll do is they'll interpret it for readers. They rarely will print this thing in full. They'll simply tell you what it says and, of course, make up stuff. Schiff, of course, is already claiming that Trump is anti-Semitic because he's opposed to this resolution and he's a Jew. The fact that his name is Schiff, I don't know if I should laugh or cry over this thing. But because, again, there's been nothing wrong here, there's been no problems, even if everything they say is true, it's not a problem at all. I don't know what can happen here. Now, the lawyers for this whistleblower, Zaid and Bakai, say that they're only going to work with lawmakers in unless their total anonymity is ensured. In other words, we can't have anyone looking into this guy. But now we know he's a CIA, a career CIA worker. And Adam Schiff himself lied about his contacts with Curamela. This has been a conspiracy for some time now. And of course, they lied, claiming there was no connection with CIA or the Democratic Party, and all of that was false. Now, what that might mean is that Senate Republicans are going to be able to subpoena things and really expose this to the point where even the American press may not be able to cover it over entirely. And the other good thing, of course, is that the press is so ridiculously partisan that trust in it has gone to nothing. We could only help those in the independent media. So as far as Curamela is concerned, and of course, many of us kind of knew this even before we knew who this guy was, but he is connected with the establishment at every level, that he's been taking guidance from Adam Schiff for months. Curamela was thrown out of the White House for leaking stories about Trump to the press. Curamela created the make-believe news story that all the media reported without criticism that Putin ordered Trump to fire Comey. Even though we're talking about military aid to Ukraine, which obviously Putin would be opposed to. Nothing makes any sense here. And not only that, his attorneys worked for Clinton and Schumer and gave money to Biden. Curamela worked for Joe Biden when he was vice president. And he's been in Ukraine before. The connections are overwhelming him. Now, the press has always been an evil force and destructive force in American politics, but I know there's a woman named Cheryl Atkinson who created what she calls a definitive list of invented and made up stories about Donald Trump by the by the media. Now remember, they were shutting down campaign rallies through threats of violence, which would nullify the election anyway, if it would happen somewhere else, throughout the campaign, prior to the election. And Trump had four assassination attempts, all from those working for the other side, which the press sat on. Now, obviously, I can't go through all the lies, but some of them are really nasty, and these are important because Trump will file suit against CNN for this. If you remember Betsy DeVos, education secretary, they made up the story that she said there needs to be guns in school to shoot grizzly bears. They invented it. The Washington Post said the State Department's entire senior administrative team had just resigned. He made it up. They claimed that he was going to invade Mexico. They made it up. CNN said in May of 2017 that in Trump's healthcare plan, rape and sexual assault were going to be considered pre-existing conditions. Ivanka Trump never plagiarized any speeches, even though this was a stand-up comic. We're talking about this for months. They would manipulate things. Like CNN's Daniel Shane was editing a speech about Trump when he said this. None of this was true. The New York Times said that the Comey was fired over the Russia investigation. Same thing for the Washington Post. And it was completely made up. One of the worst is when NBC said that Putin stated to the airhead Megyn Kelly that he had compromising information about Trump, when in fact he said the exact same thing. General Michael Flynn was supposed to have said that Trump ordered him to contact Russian officials, as if that would be a problem in and of itself. And of course, that wasn't true either. New York Times said that his family tax bill would raise taxes on a typical family by $4,000. That was also made up. One of the worst, I don't know if you remember this, Time magazine ran, and this was really awful. The fire engine red cover, completely blank. I mean, there was no wording on it other than Time and the caption. And it had that little girl from Honduras crying and Trump looking down at her. And it said, "Welcome to America." Now, of course, nothing had ever happened there. Even the girl's father said nothing had happened there. It was meant to create this mobilize people against him. NBC News said that Trump praised Robert E. Lee, as if that would be a problem. He didn't. I could go on and on and on. They claim that his rallies are empty. They simply made it up. They had thousands of people there. CNN invented a story where a breastfeeding mother had a child torn from her by ICE agents under Trump's orders. And stupid ones like MSNBC invented a story where Trump's loans had Russian cosigners. Why the hell would Trump need a cosigner for anything? And why from there? And they're not even clever ones. I mean, we're not even worth good lies anymore. And when you add these invented news stories, clearly you have a lawsuit. Because these people are destroying the presidency, for better or for worse. They're destroying Donald Trump. They're destroying his ability to engage in policy one way or the other. Making him completely, neutralizing him entirely. The point of, the point of all of this is that the notion of the original idea of impeachment was to nullify an election. And that's all they're doing here, despite what the New York Times says. Trump's lawsuit is something that we have to watch clearly. Now, it all depends on who the judge is. Because clearly, just on that short list, there's hundreds more. It's completely invented stories. He certainly has a case. These are destroyers. You can't believe anything the press says about Donald Trump or Vladimir Putin or anything else. I mean, Johnson's Law, you know, stresses the idea of an issue being in a, you know, in a foreign country in an obscure area. But the press is now so brazen that they do it right up the street from you. They'll simply invent something. And you have the entire establishment, with no exceptions, at war with him. Now, so that's the origin, the origin and the purpose of impeachment and the notion of the election of the president, which no one fully understands. And that's what this is clearly all about, and that's who the whistleblower is, and that's this whole thing is simply another conspiracy. Conspiracies are how powerful people function. The whole point of doing history or journalism is to discover the power relations behind any phenomenon that we see. Not to take the official word for things, because that's never true, but to find out where the money is, where the power is, where the influence is. And that's how we come to understand anything. That's what politics is. Therefore, it's all conspiracy. Conspiracy simply means that powerful people don't take out ads in the paper telling you what they're going to do. They do things in secret. They do things without telling anyone else. And they plan out their future. This is what powerful people do. They couldn't be powerful without it. But that's not how people use conspiracy theory. Conspiracy theory just means that you're talking about the wrong group of people using power this way. The founding generation had no conception of a mass media or the massive conglomerates of economic power, this overwhelming economic power that that would be based on. And this is another reason the Constitution doesn't make a lot of sense anymore. And we've spoken on this show and on the Daily Nationalist many times about the First Amendment applying to corporations. Well, that wasn't even an issue at the time. First of all, corporations weren't considered people that had the same rights as people, as you do today. And also because you didn't have that level of, you didn't have that level of monetization, let alone the extremely centralized power of corporations. Our opponents are in the private sector, not in the public sector. Corporate America is extremely revolutionary and liberal and has always been. They give money to every leftist group, and the left exists because of corporate money and for no other reason. The reason that the left went so crazy when Trump was talking about his wall and everything else was because so much of the American economy is based on this serf labor. People don't realize just how significant this almost slave labor is, bringing them from the third world to America, driving down wages for everybody else, and breaking any kind of worker-employee organization. Because that goes for women, too. I mean, the larger the pool of labor, the lower wages are going to go. That's the point of it. So when he said he wants to limit this, what the regime heard was that he wants to raise wages. Now, there's two different entities here. A lot of people, without really knowing, they use the word deep state, the phrase deep state. That's a neologism. And it's not the same thing as a ruling class. It works with the ruling class. It's a part of the ruling class. Now, the New York Times has fully admitted to its existence, saying, thank God, the deep state is a wonderful thing. It's not this terrible conspiracy. These are selfless civil servants, I think they said, trying to destroy an evil man. So now they've fully admitted the existence of this entity, these extremely powerful, almost completely anonymous people in the bureaucracy, with their own money, their own source of income, who can't be fired, because, you know, federal employees, almost impossible to fire them, who've been around a lot longer than Trump has, who decide how laws get interpreted and how laws get implemented. The ruling class is larger than the deep state. Now, I talk about the ruling class, and I use the word regime with the capital R to refer to the same thing. The deep state works at the pleasure of the regime, of the ruling class. These are mostly in the private sector. Now, remember, most of people in the deep state are private sector too, because so much of the federal government is contracts with private corporations. They couldn't function without that for 2 minutes. But we're talking about a ruling class. We're talking about a nobility, not in the good sense, in the true sense of the word. We're talking about an oligarchy. There's another article which is worth your time. By Mark Greendorfer. It's called Restoring Nobility to the Constitution, a Modern Approach to a Founding Principle. He's from the Zucker Legal Institute. There's a part of the Constitution that no one ever talks about. And it says, no title of nobility shall be granted by the United States, and no person holding any office of profit or trust under them shall, without the consent of Congress, accept any present and nomen office title of any kind whatsoever from any king, prince, or foreign state. Now, because people don't know what that means, they just think, well, you can't take a noble title. You can't be called sir. Lawyers really shouldn't call themselves esquire. That is a low-level noble title. And that most people say, well, there's really nothing to talk about there. But why would this matter to the founding generation? Why would they even put that in the Constitution? You can't take a noble title. What big deal? Well, even if they did, what difference would that make? So if you think about it for more than 2 minutes, you realize there's a lot more to that than meets the eye, especially today. In the Constitutional Convention debates, they talk about that quite a bit. The nobility clause was meant to keep an actual Republican state. Now, I'm no Republican, but it is an oligarchy. But the founding generation believed that they could keep republicanism from being that way. You can't have a king in America because the propaganda was against, you know, George in England. John Adams had sympathy for royalism. There were people who wanted to make George Washington a king, and he is related to English royalty going way back. But that was simply out of the question. Now, of course, the modern president has far more powers than a king did in the 18th century. But since, you know, the historical literacy is so low that you're not going to be able to understand any of this, there would be nothing wrong with someone taking a noble title. They're talking about making sure that a ruling class doesn't develop, that an oligarchy doesn't develop. It's not just noble class in the sense that they're called sir and they're a member of some order. It means any privileged group of people in a society. These were meant to be impediments against the creation of a political aristocracy, that there can't be any privileged class that doesn't meet whether by title or by their treatment. Alexander Hamilton called it the cornerstone of Republican government. For as long as they are excluded, there can never be serious danger that government will be any other than that of the people. In other words, their version of republicanism, and of course, you know, they were very naive here, but their version of republicanism was an attempt to keep oligarchy at bay. And the American case is distinctive enough. You have people like Andrew Jackson, there was a possibility that that could have worked. But again, as we've already said, the rise of the parties and the press and conglomerates destroyed all that. The concept here, now, of course, we have many privileged classes in this country. Because of the low number of people who can vote, there was a legitimate aristocracy permitted. This has nothing to do with that. When, you know, one of the most irritating phrases that people use in politics, and they refer to the American people. There is no such entity. It's an abstraction that's covering over for something else. When Madison or Hamilton refer to the people, they're referring only to free people. People who owned their own land and owned their own sources of production so that they're not under the control of anybody else. These were literate, intelligent people who were independently able to come to an opinion on important questions. And only if that was based on the common good rather than private interest. The notion of private interest having any connection with government is therefore unconstitutional. We're not just talking about a hereditary nobility here, although our nobility certainly is. It's an oligarchy. You know, there's quite a bit of class fluidity, but not at the top 1% level. And they only marry each other. The only thing that these guys cared about wasn't a title or an order, but the privilege that came with it. John Quincy Adams, you know, thought this with the Masonic lodges could not exist because it violates the nobility clause in the Constitution. The way that they define it was nobles formed a body who by their prerogative and for their own particular interest restrained the people. That's how that generation defined nobility. They what they meant was oligarchy. They certainly believed in aristocracy. But it wasn't an issue because no one believed in mass voting at the time. So the people didn't refer to everybody, never even came close to that. Politics was a function among other functions. The people refer to that 5% who had the right to vote. In Federalist number 57, this comes up again because Madison condemns the idea that any lawmaker, and by extension, any economic elite, can exempt themselves from laws, which, of course, under the nobility clause is impossible. That was the whole point of it. You can't have a group of people who are subject to the laws differently or not subject at all. That's why that's in there. In 57, Madison says this, I'll add as a fifth circumstance in the situation of the House of Representatives, restraining them from oppressive measures, that they can make no law which will not have its full operation on themselves and their friends, as well as on the great mass of society. This has always been deemed one of the strongest bonds by which human policy connect rulers with the people together. It creates between them that communion of interests and sympathy of sentiments of which few governments have furnished examples, but without which every government degenerates into tyranny. If it be asked, what is to restrain the House of Representatives from making legal discriminations in favor of themselves or a particular class of society, I answer, the genius of the whole system, the nature of just and constitutional laws, and above all, the vigilant and manly spirit which accentuates the people of America, a spirit which nourishes freedom and in return is nourished by it. And this spirit shall ever be so far debased as to tolerate law not obligatory for the legislature, as well as on the people will be prepared to tolerate anything but liberty. Now that section of Federalist 57, of course, doesn't get mentioned very much, but it's absolutely essential. He says a few things here. Now, a lot of what he says here is mystification. He's talking about the creation of any elite, a law being written by an elite group for their own purposes, which is the norm now, or laws that are passed for the profit of a specific group. That's also the norm. So none of these are constitutional. The fact that the same laws and circumstances affect both rulers and ruled is the only thing that makes a government legitimate in Madison's eyes. But that's very rarely done. Now, when he asks himself the question, what could keep them from doing this, he gets vague. The genius of the whole system, now I suppose he means checks and balances there. The nature of just and constitutional laws, which is a circular argument. But then he says, the vigilant and manly spirit, which activates the people of America. Now, this is part of why there has to be an armed militia. This is why this small percentage of the population that can vote and be involved in politics has to always be very suspicious of everything that the government does, assuming that it's all a conspiracy. Without that small, free section of the population, no government could function. Then the last line, if that should ever be debased as to tolerate corrupt laws, then the people will be prepared for tyranny. Which, of course, we've been living in that society for a very long time. I remember when I first heard about the TARP bailouts after the crash of 2008, and I said, the American Free Press or something like that. I said, if this is accepted by the population without an extreme reaction, then the battle's over. They won't sacrifice for anything. And that's exactly what happened. The taxpayer permitted themselves to have trillions extracted from them to bail out their oppressors without a shred of any, you know, Democratic or Republican well-being at all, or any kind of Democratic connection. And they did nothing about it. The things that the American population accepts are so laughable, that ISIS is a real thing. The pictures that they see, just these made-up stories that this leader of ISIS was killed for the 28th time. By the way, in that regard, Russian intelligence has issued a report saying that Trump's description of the raid on his compound never happened. And they actually produced all the logs, because they monitor everything in that area, that there was no concentration of forces or aircraft in that area at the time. So they've proven that it's been completely made up. But most Americans will accept it. They know, they'll accept it, realizing that they just heard last year that he was killed, and the year before, and the year before, and the year before. And the fact that we could think most people still remember that the fake Osama killing, Osama died in 2001, that he was dumped overboard so no one can inspect the body. Then they claim that this was a part of Muslim tradition, which no one had ever heard of before. What did they do to this guy? They dumped him over the side of a boat. In other words, they're almost goading people into seeing that this is all phony. So what Madison says here, that when people are so debased as to tolerate this kind of thing, it's over. When we talk about a nobility and the nobility clause, because the ruling class controls all of this. And it's at a point where they're almost experimenting. They're seeing how far they can go. And there seems to be no limit. The whole notion of the, you know, egalitarianism back in the founding era referred to the people in the true sense, that 5-10% of the population who were free enough and educated enough and literate enough and knew their history, especially in Greek and Latin, to make an informed judgment about politics. Like everyone at the time, they didn't believe that you had a right to an opinion. Not unless you are a specialist, not unless you are in this group of people who are free enough, and of course free from, you know, what today we'd call media control. Andrew Jackson, when he vetoed the charter for the bank, the second bank, he made reference to this nobility clause, saying that this would create a noble class. And now that that exists, the noble class also exists. Again, I don't like using noble, but that's, we're using it in a very general sense. There is oligarchy. And what he said at the time, what Jackson said at the time was this. He said, in the full enjoyment of the gifts of heaven and the fruits of superior industry, economy, and virtue, every man is equally entitled to protection by law. When the laws undertake to add to these natural and just advantages artificial distinctions, to grant titles, gratuities, exclusive privileges, to make the rich richer and the potent more powerful, the humble members of society, the farmers, mechanics, and laborers, who have neither the time nor the means of securing like favors to themselves, have a right to complain of the injustice of their government. But after the fiasco in the bank, where the bank was eventually imposed on America, the nobility clause was forgotten. I don't know if I've ever, up until recently, even read a paper on the subject that no one ever talks about. It's simply a non-issue. So it was very clear, even in the convention debates themselves, and in the Federalists, and this is something the Anti-Federalists brought up over and over again, that the nobility clause is there to protect this Republican experiment which was a federation of local governments, that prohibits at a blanket level any representative of the population, any representative of the economic class, rising to a status of privilege through those means. Not just status and opportunity, but of legal standing. What we mean by this, in the economic terms, is the charging of rents. What they mean by nobility is what we would refer to as the ability to charge a rent. There's a market price for an object. A rent is when, through your position, you could increase the price of that based on some legal standing that you happen to have. So a rent is charged if, you know, you sell your influence to allow a company to pollute or something like that. That cost is above and beyond what the market would charge, and therefore that's a rent. It's money that's extracted from the population through strictly legal means, or I should say political means, that you're in a position to do this. A monopoly, an oligarchy, by definition, everything they do is a rent. That wouldn't be the market price for something. It's because they rule so completely, they could charge what they want. Charles Larson, a professor some years ago, talking about the nobility clause, he said, the scope of the nobility clause was not limited to holding office. It extended to any form of privilege provided by the government. As another Federalist explained, under the Constitution, there could never be any nobility in the states or person possessed of any rights or privileges, but what are common to the meanest subject. Which means that the founding generation was pretty radical in that respect. The statement that Madison made in the Federalist above, it's also reflected in something that John Adams, who's one of the few Federalists I actually like, my favorite of the founding, non-anti-Federalist founding generation. Here's what he says. When I consider the weakness, the folly, the pride, the vanity, the selfishness, the artifice, the low craft, and mean cunning, the want of principle, the avarice, the unbounded ambition, the unfair cruelty of the majority of those in all nations who are allowed an aristocratical influence. On the other hand, the stupidity with which the more numerous multitude not only become their dupes, but even love to be taken in by their tricks, I feel a stronger disposition to weep at their destiny than to laugh at their folly. This is something that couldn't be uttered today. He's talking about the existence of conspiracies. This is what we mean by mean cunning, want of principle, avarice, unfounded ambition, cruelty. This can only be done through conspiracy. It can't be done through normal means. John Adams, again, in 1807, wrote this. Democracy will soon degenerate into anarchy. Such an anarchy that every man will do what is right in his own eyes, and no man's life or property or reputation or liberty will be secure, and every one of these will soon mold itself into a system of subordination of all the moral virtues and intellectual abilities, all the powers of wealth, beauty, wit, and science, to the wanton pleasures, the capricious will, and the execrable cruelty of one or a very few. So what's the situation today? Joe Biden says this, 2015. He said, you have to go where the money is. Now where the money is, there's almost always implicitly some strings attached. It's awful hard to take a whole lot of money from a group you know has a particular position, then you conclude that they're wrong and vote no. So Biden right there is admitting everything that we're talking about. He's admitting that there is no legitimacy to this impeachment, even though this is back in 2015. That what his son did was absolutely wrong. The Texas Agricultural Commissioner, Jim Hightower. 2015, he said, today's whole political game, run by an absurdist nightmare of moneyed elites, is ridiculous. A game which corporations are people, and money is magically empowered to speak. Candidates trek to the corporate suites and secret retreats of the rich, shamelessly selling their political souls. Again, that's called conspiracy. Russ Feingold, the senator from Wisconsin, said, "People tell me all the time that our politics in Washington are broken and that multimillionaires, billionaires, and big corporations are calling the shots. It's hard not to agree." Even Ted Cruz, that same year, he said, "Lobbyists and career politicians make up what I call the Washington cartel. They, on a daily basis, are conspiring against the American people. Career politicians, ears and wallets are open to the highest bidder." Now, I don't know how he exempts himself from that. If you remember, during the campaign, I wrote something, on a cryptic statement that Cruz made. I don't know if I've mentioned this before or not, but he made a big issue out of privatizing federal lands. And it took me a minute. Why bring this up? No one cares about that. Why would you even mention that? And then it occurred to me. Privatizing federal lands means that federal government can sell, probably at very low cost, prime real estate to the oligarchs that they could then develop to tremendous profit. And of course, destroy these areas. Now, the point of it is, he wasn't talking to voters there. When he made that statement, "I'm going to privatize federal land," he made a big issue about it. No one questioned him on it. It was just people kind of, you know, said, okay, not understanding that he wasn't talking to them. He was talking to the millionaires. He was talking to people saying, "I will be your man. I will give this away to you if you support me." And if you listen to campaign speeches and you are very careful and you listen for these kind of strange, almost cryptic utterances, you begin to realize they're not talking to you. They're talking to someone else. And in one given speech, they can go back and forth. Senator Dick Durbin in 2009 said, "The banks, hard to believe in a time where we're facing a banking crisis, that many of the banks created and are still the most powerful lobby on Capitol Hill and frankly own the place." Now I have, and I'm willing to send to anybody, I think the definitive list of the major Jewish names in the banking industry. Single-spaced, 12-point font, it comes to 17 pages. Now, if you want to talk about a nobility, and the reason why no one talks about the nobility clause, Jewish rule is clearly denounced by it. Not media, music, entertainment. I have the definitive list of these people. And it's page after page after page. It's ridiculous. It's completely Jewish. It's shocking at the upper levels and even the median levels. Be born a Jew in America and not be wealthy or successful is almost impossible. There's not that many of them. That's nobility that this founding generation wanted to condemn. Even Barney Frank, who was a filthy man from Massachusetts in the 90s, he said, "We're the only people in the world required by law to take large amounts of money from strangers and then act as if it has no effect on our behavior." Even the Progressive Party, in 1912, in their platform, they say, "Behind the ostensible government sits enthroned an invisible government, owing no allegiance and acknowledging no responsibility to the people. To destroy this invisible government, to dissolve the unholy alliance between corrupt businesses and the corrupt politics, is the first task of the statesmanship of this day." And this party was founded by former President Theodore Roosevelt. When you see oil firms using the military as their private bodyguard, when you see the military officer class coming out of the academies, these are noble aristocracies that they're oligarchies that the Constitution expressly forbids. Now, I have a paper out condemning, quoting from all the professors at these academies, that these are completely phony, there's no standards, it's not hard to get into, this is all mythology. The service academies produce monsters. I've been through this on paper several times before. But what it creates is a self-aware, self-contained, arrogant group of guys who believe they could do no wrong. And this is why the bulk of the crimes committed by officers are those coming out of the academies, even though only 12% of the higher ranks actually are academy graduates. All of these, and initially, Davy Crockett, who I mentioned when he was congressman, condemned the academies based on the nobility clause. So, what's the connection? The ruling class is what's dumbed people down to the point where Russiagate and Ukrainegate can actually be taken seriously by anybody. In either one of these cases, there's no actual allegation of wrongdoing. There's just an assumption that because it sounds complicated, it's therefore wrong. If Donald Trump even threatened to withhold aid based on some issue of justice, there's nothing wrong with that. That's why foreign aid exists. Foreign aid always has strings attached. That's what foreign aid is. The assumption here is that foreign aid can only be done out of altruism, but that doesn't happen in politics. Foreign aid exists to get a country to do something. Food aid was withheld from North Korea, the string being based on their nuclear program. Same thing for Iraq before Saddam Hussein left and was killed. Aid was based entirely on the behavior of the state. In every country, except Israel, in every country, that's the assumption. So even if all of this stuff they're talking about is true, he's done nothing wrong. What society could exist where an issue can be invented like this, where even at its worst, there's no wrongdoing, and yet still have a impeachment hearing? This is why I quoted Madison in that Federalist paper. When you have a group of people, when you have a population who are willing, or John Adams, when he said that they even enjoy being dominated by this oligarchy and accept it and condemn conspiracy theorists as a way to protect themselves mentally from understanding this stuff, they will vote for anything but liberty because they're incapable, absolutely incapable of understanding freedom and living a free life. Because living a free life is very, very, very difficult, as I know very well. Thank you, everyone, for listening. I'll talk to you next time. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to The Orthodox Nationalist with Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson at RadioArian.com.